Other comments? Yes.
I have two questions for you. First of all, you mentioned the effect of anonymity or de-individuation in your studies, and I noticed that there was anonymity on both sides, right? In the guards case, the anonymity of the sunglasses and so on, and the uniforms. In the other case, the number. In the other study, the shockers and the ones who were shocked were both de-individuated. I was wondering if there's been any study into the differences between the anonymity of those who are doing the evil and those who are receiving it. For instance, is there a difference if someone knew that they would not be anonymous in what they were doing, but they didn't know who they were doing it to, or if they knew that they were anonymous, but they knew that this individual they were doing it to was the one receiving it?
That's a good question. In the Milgram study, he has one condition where if you are in the same room as the victim, then obedience level goes way down. It's like being a bombardier, you know. I mean, if you're looking down, there's a map, and you're dropping bombs. You know, you're not dropping on people; you're just dropping bombs, which is different than, you know. Let me back up. What was really difficult in the Second World War was to get people to use their bayonet on the enemy. It took a lot of training, desensitization. A lot of that was a whole training program. You start by sticking it into straw thing, then you stick it into cows or dead horses, because when you put it in, blood is flying all over. It's not a video game that's all out there. It's everywhere. But killing just is easier the more remote it is, the more you don't have to think in your mind that this is a human being like me. It's really critical to dehumanize. See, dehumanization takes place in your head. It's like a cortical cataract that blinds you to humanity. And once you begin to dehumanize, then it's easy. All stereotypes do that. When you think of somebody in the Vietnam War, gooks or geeks or niggas or spics or wops, or, you know, the use of those terms takes away the dignity, humanity of somebody else, and then it makes it easy to tell dirty jokes about them, to hit them, to punish them, to do anything.
Okay. And quickly, the other thing that struck me in the case where you defended that that soldier or right. analyzed him, right? It seemed that you were defending him by showing that he had a normal psyche and he was just put in a bad circumstance he couldn't control. Yeah. Well, in other cases here, commonly where you try and defend somebody, saying, well, they've got this abnormal psyche that they can't control. So I wonder, you know, if you have a normal psyche and it's still behind your control, you have an abnormal psyche, it's beyond your control, is there any place for guilt? And what what should the judicial system do about that?
It's a really great question. My defense was only to mitigate the extremity of the sentencing. He said he's guilty, so that was an issue. He got 8 years. The question is, should we change legal theory, which says it's all in the person? If I can document that until this guy stepped down those steps, he was as normal, healthy, all-American as possible, and then within a few weeks, he's doing these terrible things, to say, well, he had free will, he didn't have to do it. Everybody who was on the night shift did it. So that wipes that out. It's not some did, some didn't. Everybody who was in that crucible of human nature did those terrible things in that night shift. Or they looked the other way. Nobody challenged it. So there really has to be a revolution in legal theory, which says, to what extent do we take into account situational forces as described in the Milgram study, in my book. I have two whole chapters on all the research on the power of the situation. And do we take into account the system? The Nuremberg trials and all international tribunals, that's really what they're doing. They're putting the system on trial. But the system is always people. It's Milosevic, you know, it's Saddam Hussein. It's always people who are at the top who set the stage. And that's the important thing about international tribunals. So we do recognize that in some cases the system is responsible. On May 4, 2004, when these pictures were seen, the Abu Ghraib pictures, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld came before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And he said to them, these abuses occurred on my watch. As Secretary of Defense, therefore, I am fully responsible. Should he be in a prison cell next to Chip Frederick, or should he be behind a big fancy desk at Stanford's Hoover Institution? I think he should go to prison, not go to Hoover Institution. You can't say I'm responsible for the abuses and then not be responsible, to say, I'm responsible, but, you know, just get the guy, the grunts at the bottom of the line. Other questions?
My question to you is, if you were going to do it again, how would you change the Stanford Prison Experiment? And given what developed in the emotional breakdowns, would you do it again?
No. My study and Milgram's study has permanently prevented any kind of research like that, again, ever being done. The sad thing is that the pendulum has swung so far that there's almost no behavioral research that actually puts people in behavioral context. So most research is paper and pencil. How do you think you would behave if you were a guard in the following situation? It's not until you're in the situation that you can experience what those forces are. I can describe it. I can give you 10-page scenarios, and it's not the same as feeling the power of camaraderie or feeling the pressure that other guys are putting on you to do this. What I would change is very simple. The reason this got out of control is I was the principal investigator and I was also the superintendent of the prison. Those are incompatible roles. That there should have been someone who, and there was nobody there to blow the whistle except me. I did, but, you know, not too late. I should have blown the whistle after the second prisoner broke down. When the first one broke down, you could say, well, maybe our screening procedure failed, that we let somebody through who was defective. But once the second one broke down, we said, look, we've demonstrated, that's it. We've demonstrated the power of the situation. But at that point, I'm thinking like a superintendent of a prison. My job is to maintain the security and the stability of my institution. So there's a rumor when that young man, prison 8612, breaks down, that he's going to bring his friends, they're going to break into the prison. I go to the Palo Alto Police Department, I say, I want to move all the prisoners in our prison down to your old jail. And I persuade him to do it. It's only the last minute, the city manager calls up and says, no, we can't do this, we'll get sued if something happens and so forth. But so I'm thinking like a prison superintendent. And I'm angry with this guy. I say, where's the institutional cooperation between correctional officers? The guy must have thought I was a lunatic, you know. So essentially it's, if I did it again, it's separating those two roles, having somebody who has the power to stop the study. The other thing is this went through Human Subjects Committee, and they approved it. Why did they approve it? Because it's kids playing cops and robbers in an experiment. If it's an experiment, you quit, right? They couldn't imagine that the situation got so profound that no one thought in terms of quitting an experiment. They thought of being paroled from the Stanford prison experiment, from the Stanford prison. It stopped being an experiment. It was a prison. So that's the hard. So after the fact, you say, look at these terrible things that happened. After the fact, what happened in Guyana, in Jonestown, it was horrendous. Before that, Jim Jones was a hero in San Francisco. He was put in charge of housing. He was a buddy of Moscone, Rosalind Carter. Anybody who came to the city would visit him because he had organized 2,000 people, elderly. He was preaching brotherhood and racial integration. And so until he got to the jungle and started doing this really crazy stuff, up to that point, he was a good citizen, you know, a doer of more good deeds than bad deeds.
Just a couple more questions here.
You guys got to go back to work.
I just wanted to ask a question about, you mentioned this sort of 90% of people will obey and do the evil, the situational evil, but how can we sort of strive to be that 10%?
Yeah, and no, 90% only when you're in a situation where you see other people like you go all the way. So, I mean, where it's facilitated, socially facilitated.
Sure, but on your section on heroism, you kind of went into how can we strive, you know,
right,
not to be in that group. What I thought you were going to say, and what I guess I'm wondering about is, I thought you would say something more like, when you're in a situation that begs for heroism, heroism can become the equivalent, where people will, you know, in much the same way that these are ordinary people doing evil things, that you can have ordinary people step up to do heroic things. But it sounded instead as if you were saying that for the ordinary person to do the heroic thing, he has to find a way to step into that role of that 10%. Why do you suppose it is that situations, in much the same way that they can lend themselves to evil, don't lend themselves to heroism?
No, I said they do. I mean,
Maybe I misunderstood.
No, I said the same situation. that inflames the hostile imagination. So the same situation that made Chip Frederick and these other people do bad things made Joe Darby do something good.
So would you say that
the same situation that made 70 people freeze on that platform made, you know, that situation facilitated Wesley Autry's act of heroism. So I'm saying the same situation can do those three things. Most people do nothing. You freeze, you know, you don't want to get involved, do bad or do good. So I'm saying it's inherent in the same situation as seeds of evil and the seeds of good.
Okay, that's okay, right. So then, but you would say then there would be situations, separate ones, that would lend themselves to heroism in much the same way that certain ones...
Yeah, but okay, I mean, what I'm saying, for me, the biggest problem we have now, one of the biggest everyday problem, is bullying and teasing in schools. Recent research shows 25% to 30% of all kids report being teased and bullied in school. That means they end up hating school. If they hate school, they're going to do poorly in school. If they do poorly in school, their whole life is going to be ruined. They're going to hate going to school. Who knows that bullying is going on? Everybody. Everybody in a classroom knows who's being bullied, and typically it's kids who are shy who get bullied because they're more fragile, that you know they're not going to defend themselves. You know, so my sense is that's a profound evil. And now it's cyberbullying. Then you use the anonymity of the internet, and you go on, you say, you know, Janie is really popular with the boys because she's a slut, she puts out, or Billy gets all the good grades because he cheats. Your reputation is ruined because there's no way to undo that. So I'm saying, so here's a kind of everyday evil that you have to now change the system, that to combat bullying has to go from top down. The principal, the teachers, the parents have to be involved. Not let's find the bully and punish him, because there's endless number of bullies out there. Okay? It's in the situation, the system, you say, there is zero tolerance for bullying and teasing other than, you know, lighthearted, friendly thing. And when you do, we expect kids to anonymously turn them in. Same thing if you have an honest code. You know, you don't have to be here and go and say, Jimmy cheated. But you can do it anonymously. You can say, so-and-so cheated, or, you know, the teacher did such and such. My sense is we have to rethink how the system allows these kinds of everyday heroes, everyday evil to go on, and what do you have to do to challenge that system as a kid in the class? For example, I mean, it's a slightly different thing. 600 kids were taking the law school exam, and somebody in the back room had a seizure, fell out of his seat, you know, moaning, and everybody know. 598 kids continue with their exam. Two kids got up to help him. And they got penalized. They didn't give them extra time until they complained and made the media and so forth. So here's a situation where, you know, you're going to be a lawyer, you want to do good for... Here's somebody like you who has a seizure. And unlike Wesley Autry, only 2 of 600 got up out of the seat to help this guy. Well, I mean, again, you know, how do you begin to promote a heroic imagination? So as soon as that happened, everybody would stop. If somebody had something, just get up and say, time out. So you don't need 600 people, but you just challenge the system to say, we're all stopping, rather than these two guys are going to get penalized because they're the Good Samaritans.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question. So who thinks they have the best question?
Come on.
Hey, so it's sort of two-part. One's more of a comment. Actually, there was on NPR pretty recently a story about a teacher who basically, you know, in her classroom said, it was elementary school, you cannot say to any kids that you can't play. If you tell another kid you can't play, you know, you're sent out for recess. And it actually worked not just for recess play, but for preventing bullying, right? Because, you know, everyone plays together, it's okay. Better. But so how do we... So that sort of made a systemic change, I think, that prevented the bullying. But how do we do that for things like prisons, where systemically they are meant for control? I mean, like, do you have, are there any suggestions? Has there been any research into a more positive experience?
No. I mean, so you get in prisons, the fundamental of prison is guards are afraid of prisoners. There's a few guards in a lot of prisons. And prisoners are, you know, strong and many of them are violent. And so what you really want is you want the prisoners to fight each other. You don't want them to fight you. Or you want the prisoners to sexually, degrade one another. You know, And so you look the other way. So everybody knows that if you're a young guy going to prison, you're going to be gang raped over and over again. And you know it. I mean, the system knows it. They do nothing to, really nothing to protect you. They know there are gang fights between, you know, racial groups. So, and at some level, they allow it to happen because if you're fighting each other, you're not fighting the system, fighting the guards. So this has to be above that. I mean, the change of system has to be above that. If you take prisons, prisons are a social experiment that has failed. It's an experiment. Society says, what are we going to do with people who don't follow our rules? Well, we're going to separate them from their family, from their community. There are 2 million people in prisons in America, more than any country in the world. It costs us billions of taxpayers' money to keep those people there. It costs $1 million to keep one guy in prison for 20 years. And now we're putting more people in for a longer time. Unions actively prevent prisons from teaching prisoners a trade because they don't want them to come out and take jobs away from union-paying members. So here's this failure. When I say failure, the recidivism rate of almost every prison in the country is 60%. Within 3 years of being released, you go right back to the prison. And research I did said 1/4 of the time, the second offense is much more serious than the first. In many cases, you're learning how to be more of a criminal. So here's something that fails, that we're paying this huge amount of money for. And what we do is say, let's build more prisons. We're privatizing them. We're making a big business, making it, you know, for profit only, same way we're privatizing our army. So here's a failure. I mean, and so you need a total system change, but there's nobody willing to do it. In California, the most powerful union in all of California is the California Correctional Officers Union, because they give huge amounts of money to Democrats and to the Republicans, and they have stymied any attempts at reform, starting the governor down, and they're the ones who get more prisons built. They want to have prisons built. They want to have the prisons filled with prisoners because that's their job. So I'm saying that for me, that's really, you know, really an issue. How do we change prisons as a failed social experiment? Because it's costing us too much money, and especially devastating black and Hispanic communities. There are probably more blacks in prison than in college now. Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Professor Philip Zimbardo of Stanford University on his book, The Lucifer Effect, from a videotaped presentation released to the public from Google's Author Series. If you can view video online, I urge you to see this program in its entirety, which includes documentary images from Abu Ghraib and the Stanford Prison Experiment, which were a powerful part of Zimbardo's presentation. You can find it by Googling Zimbardo Google. Zimbardo was spelled Zimbardo. A few comments before going on to the next section that will provide a different take on the same topic. It's ironic that Zimbardo suggests a school curriculum to inspire people to act on their moral imagination, to oppose the dictates of authority and the forces of social conformity, when the institution of school, both primary and higher education, have been deliberately designed to produce conformists who will accept their assigned place in a dominance hierarchy, a case that was proved extensively both in the writings of John Taylor Gatto in his book, The Underground History of Education, that dealt with compulsory primary schooling, read on the program earlier this year, and Jeff Schmidt's book, Disciplined Minds, which I read on the air a couple of years ago, that makes a similar analysis of the process of professional education. If you're a new listener, you can find those shows in the archive at unwelcomeguests.org. Another thing I noticed was the people who became situational torturers were judged to be normal, according to some psychological standard. I don't know what that standard is, but if normal means within the range of what is generally considered acceptable, what does it mean to have a so-called normal personality in a society that rests on a foundation of hierarchies of domination and is held together with the threat of coercion and punishment, is obsessed with winning, which must also create losers, and ranking, being number one and being on the winning team, keeping up with the Joneses, where excess and avarice and celebrity are admired. The use of the term hero is also a problematic one, given that it is also applied to the men in uniform that will abandon their moral imagination to become the obedient executors of their leader's will. Our final segments will focus on the public policy debate about the justification of torture, the ticking time bomb, and the so-called war on terrorism. Even having a meaningful discussion on this issue is, in my view, hampered by the terms terrorism and terrorist, which makes it sound as if one is dealing with a species, the terrorist, whose nature is to perform terrorism. The thing called terrorism is a form of combat employed by a militarily weak group against a powerful one, designed to use fear, surprise, and uncertainty to compensate for lack of military might in order to rectify what is, from their perspective, an intolerable situation. Just as nice, normal people can become government torturers, they can also become, quote, terrorists. While a guy with explosives strapped to his body who blows himself up on a bus while yelling Allah Akbar is so far from most Americans' frame of reference that it's easy to imagine them as some other species with incomprehensible motives, let me share with you a bit about a terrorist I once knew personally, who most Americans would feel perfectly comfortable having a beer with. He was a helpful, friendly, patient person with a wisecracking sense of humor who enjoyed reading and chess. He was my co-worker on a job I had when I lived in the Republic of Ireland, and when we became friends, I learned about his background. The Republic of Ireland had a tacit policy to offer safe haven to IRA fighters from Northern Ireland who were wanted by British authorities if they were willing to become law-abiding civilians and forego further IRA activity. I never asked him about the specifics of his past actions, but I knew it involved bombs. I wasn't a radio producer in those days, so I felt no compulsion to stick a microphone in his face and demand an interview, which he probably wouldn't have given me anyway, as it would have compromised his status with the Irish government, which officially pretended ignorance of the presence of IRA fighters in their midst, and merely asserted that all Irish people, including those of the six counties of Ulster, were citizens of the Republic of Ireland and entitled to live anywhere in Ireland they chose. Abortion was illegal in Ireland, and Irish women who needed abortions had to travel to England to get them. At that time, there was political pressure from some quarters to pass a law that would criminalize those women who went abroad. Though he did not support this law, my friend was raised a Catholic and believed abortion was murder of an innocent person. Not my view at all. In response to my statement that I rejected the government forcing me to bear a child against my will, he said he would be happy to lie on his back for 9 months in order to save someone's life, anyone's life, and why wasn't I willing to do that? He saw this as completely different from placing a bomb in a restaurant. That was a matter of fighting for his people's freedom, who had been conquered and dispossessed by a foreign power, robbed of their land, had their language and culture deliberately eradicated, and who now lived as second-class citizens in their ancient homeland, as the last remnant of the British Empire. I doubt he would have betrayed his comrades under torture, nor the location of a ticking time bomb. During that period, 10 IRA prisoners died on a hunger strike protesting the Thatcher government's refusal to treat them as prisoners of war. Thatcher's policy led to more, not less, violence, and two of the hunger strikers were elected to Parliament shortly before their deaths. Our final pieces of audio are excerpts from a hearing of the U.S. Helsinki Commission on Torture and Other Forms of Banned Treatment, that was held December 10, 2007, at the University of Maryland. The Helsinki Commission is a congressional committee chaired by Representative Alcee Hastings of Florida and Senator Benjamin Cardin of Maryland, which oversees compliance with the 1975 treaty signed in Helsinki that formed the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, of which the United States is among the 56 signatory nations. I'm going to play you some of the witness testimony from the proceedings, which were recorded by C-SPAN. Senator Cardin introduces the witnesses.
Dr. Thomas Hilde is a professor at the School of Public Policy here at the University of Maryland. He's editor of a forthcoming book on torture. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to speak here in front of the Helsinki Commission. As mentioned, I'm an ethicist and social and political philosopher, soon to publish a book on torture. And I've been asked to speak about some of the moral ramifications of torture. Historically, physical and psychological torture has been used to suppress dissent, force renunciation of beliefs, extract confessions, punish, force denunciation of others, intimidate a population, humiliate people, and gather information. All torturers claim a state of necessity. Recently, some have advanced the claim of significant information, once again, to justify torture. They argue that the information gained from torture is of greater moral significance than the torture of individual human beings. As with most ethical issues, how the problem is articulated is of crucial importance. Today, torture is commonly justified by a state of necessity, emblematic in the proverbial ticking time bomb, which frames the issue wrongly from the outset and grounds it in a state of fear. A better understanding of what is entailed in seeking morally significant information through torture belies the justification. Torture works in that torture victims speak. Although the information is notoriously unreliable, as noted since the time of Aristotle, accounts of torture from the Inquisitions exhibit the most delirious and fantastic tales from the victims. This information served to confirm the prior beliefs of the torturers. Bad weather, for instance, was thought to be caused by airborne demons in consort with human witches. Torture victims confirmed these beliefs, providing the names of other witches who would reconfirm both the preposterous prior beliefs and the Inquisitor's authority. If information must be of great moral significance to justify torture, how would we know it was of such significance? First, torturing for information requires the institutionalization of torture. There must be trained torturers and thus also trainers, a legal and administrative apparatus, a cadre of doctors and lawyers and data analysts, and so on, all of whom would be required to suspend their moral decency. Second, since raw information from an individual torture victim is unreliable, morally significant information is unlikely to be gained from an individual victim alone. Torture must be used broadly. On occasion, the torturers might have prior expectations that the prisoner indeed possesses important information. But this may obviate any perceived need to torture. The justification of morally significant information demands prior knowledge that the torture victim possesses this information. More likely than the time bomb case of torturing one bad person is the case of torturing many innocent people in search of what might justify the act of torture. How does one know when one has true information? What one does when one seeks to justify torture by gaining important information is presuppose that such information exists, which will only be discovered through a morally heinous practice. The information must thus be previously unknown in order to justify using torture. Yet, its moral significance must also be previously known in order to justify the act. It's not meaningful information until one has tortured, gained information, and then verified it. This is where information may become meaningful, but it's not necessarily true, as noted in the account of the Inquisition. The victim's guilt need never be resolved. One incentive raised by the argument for torture as a means of gathering information is to seek patterns of information rather than attempt to verify or falsify individual bits of data. comprehensive sets of data points yield more complex patterns. The more extensive the institution, the more successful torture will be. If one tortures indiscriminately and broadly, one thus obtains more complex patterns and a better understanding of what is meaningful in the information. Patterns of information by themselves are meaningless, but they serve to corroborate and verify bits of information and infer other patterns. A descriptive narrative may be interpreted and assembled from the resulting patterns and regularities. At no point has meaningful information risen to the level of morally significant information that could justify torture in the time bomb scenario. We end up with a swelling institution in search of its moral justification, causing increasing damage to innocents and ourselves, all in search of the supreme moral justification, the time bomb, only to find that in the end, it's we who have become the moral equivalent of the time bomb. Every ethical and religious tradition views torture as abhorrent. Since the proposed moral justification for torture as information gathering is itself morally unjustifiable, and since the other purposes of torture are plainly unacceptable, we're better off treating the prohibition of torture as morally absolute.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hilde, for your testimony. We'll now turn to Dr. Christian Davenport, who is a professor of political science at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow and director of research at the Center for International Development and Conflict Management. His research includes the relationship between democracy and human rights. Dr. Davenport, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, sir. Chairman and distinguished members of the Commission, I thank you for the invitation to testify about my research and the impact of democracy on prevention of torture in particular and human rights violations in general. I also wish to recognize the exemplary efforts of the Commission members to draw attention to the criminal act of torture in the United States, as well as the Commission's continuing effort to investigate this issue worldwide. I applaud you for the work you've done to date and will continue to do. And I'm both flattered and pleased to be able to offer some small assistance in this important endeavor here today. My testimony today draws primarily on research that I've undertaken with Professor Will Moore at Florida State University and David Armstrong at Oxford University, though I also rely on research projects conducted by myself and others in the team and work in the broader community of scholars interested in the violation of human rights generally and the use of torture specifically. Several international treaties, such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Convention Against Torture, make torture illegal, and while the Helsinki Final Act does not explicitly mention torture, both commit state signatories to respect human rights broadly construed and respect their international obligations under other treaties. Further, and just as important, the U.S. Constitution, of course, U.S. federal law, prohibit the use of torture by U.S. officials and their employees. Those international treaties and similar domestic laws in other nations prohibit the use of torture elsewhere throughout the world. Yet contrary to popular understanding, the use of torture remains widespread. Existing data that's provided in the testimony I submitted to the commission roughly show that 80% of the countries of the world torture at least one individual under the government's control in any given year over the period between 1981 and 1999, focus of our research. Indeed, the prohibition against torture is the most widely violated of the human rights to the personal integrity of the person. With that background, the shocked reaction to the revelation of the acts of inhuman and degrading treatment and torture of inmates in Abu Ghraib prison led me and my colleagues to undertake a scientific inquiry to determine whether the institutions that support liberal democracy, as popular franchise, diverse accountability mechanisms, and freedom of expression, reduce the likelihood of torture by governments during the late 20th century. The institutions that support liberal democracy are strongly associated throughout the globe with freedom, good governance, and human rights. There has been little investigation, however, the extent to which these institutions in particular reduce the use of torture. In fact, there's only one that we've identified. Our research attempted to fill this gap. I wish to share 3 points with you today. First, torture is distressingly common. Second, while countries with institutions that support liberal democracy do engage in torture with a considerably lower likelihood than countries that lack such institutions, this difference only holds when no groups engage in acts of violence to challenge the government or its policies. When at least one group commits at least one act of violence, countries with institutions that support liberal democracy are effectively just as likely to use torture as countries that do not have such institutions. Finally, I wish to briefly describe the extent to which each type of institution influences the likelihood of torture. I'll briefly relate each point in turn, and then close with some observations about what this research implies for those of us, like this Honorable Commission, who wish to stand vigil in defense of human rights and press governments to eschew the use of torture. It's an unpleasant truth of the human condition that torture is ordinary. Your invitation of December 3rd, 2007 asked me to address the aberration of torture in a democracy. While I do not wish to quarrel with the chairman and the members of the distinguished panel, I do wish to observe that between 81 and 99, 80% of the world committed at least one act every year, and only 20% committed zero acts of reported torture. It is important to be clear about the definition of which these statistics are based. We refer to torture as the purposeful inflicting of extreme pain, whether mental or physical, by government officials or by private individuals at the instigation of government officials. Torture includes the use of physical other force by police and prison guards that is cruel, inhuman, or degrading. Torture can be anything from simple beatings to other practices such as rape or administering shock or electrocution as a means of getting information or a forced confession. Seen in historical perspective, torture is less common today than it has been in centuries past, and democracies are less likely to use torture as a regular interrogation practice. Yet this long historical trend aside, the use of torture is common and widespread across countries with all types of institutions. Yet recent research has documented the countries with liberal democratic institutions are notably different in the type of torture they employ. More specifically, as international and national monitoring of the treatment of prisoners has increased over the past century, democracies have responded by innovating clean methods of torture that do not leave permanent marks or other evidence of pain or physical trauma. Now, research demonstrates that a percentage of countries which use torture in a given year jumps from 80 to 98% when at least one group engages in one act of violence against the government in that year. Put differently, during the final two decades of the 20th century, nearly every country that was faced with a violent challenge to its rule engaged in torturous activity. Social science is less precise than we would like, of course, yet a figure like 98% jumps out at anyone, especially when one considers that governments seek to hide torture. The data we have is certainly an undercount of actual torturous activity, thus it is quite likely that this figure is something of an underestimate. My own research, as well as that of others, has demonstrated that liberal democratic institutions, such as the popular franchise, checks and balances, and freedom of expression, reduce violations of human rights, especially physical integrity of the person. Yet, historical research of government repression of dissidents revealed that governments in countries with democratic institutions tend to shift from overt to covert tactics to repress dissident groups. Put more directly, while democratic institutions are strongly associated with greater observance of physical integrity rights on average, their impact is seriously eroded when groups in those countries resort to violence to challenge the government and its policies. What works in decreasing torture? We show that elections themselves have no impact on the likelihood that a government uses torture when dissident groups engage in violent activity. We do find that a combination of both higher voter turnout and close legislative electoral outcomes are associated with a reduced likelihood of torture given violent dissent, but only when the country has not been using torture previously. The combination of an independent judiciary and a legislature with high levels of opposition party representation reduces the likelihood of use of torture in the presence of violent dissent, though only when there has been no torture in the preceding year. Finally, while protection of the right to freedom of press strongly reduces the likelihood the government uses torture in the absence of violent dissent, that effect disappears when dissident groups undertake violent activity. Now, champions of democracy and human rights will find little cheer in the findings I discuss. Research shows that not only torture is depressingly common, that democracies have led a global shift to clean techniques that make torture harder to detect, but that institutions that define liberal democracy have little effect on the use of torture when they are most needed, when groups that oppose the government and its policies turn to violent means to press their political views on society. Government rightly has the responsibility to protect the body politic from predation by those who would tend to try to tear it asunder. Protecting citizens' right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness falls within that charge, yet it is government more than any other human institution that deprecates the physical integrity rights of human beings, and torture is the most common offense of governments in this domain. Contemporary research exposes as fiction the notion that the institutions that are justly celebrated as the foundation of liberal democracy largely and almost completely fail to deter governments from engaging in torture when the government is challenged by violent dissent. To be sure, these institutions considerably reduce the likelihood of torture in the absence of a violent challenge to government, but that important constraint more or less evaporates in the face of violent dissident activity. Now, preliminary work suggests that it is civil society, not government institutions, that can stop torture once it has begun. Civil society tends to thrive in the absence of liberal democratic institutions, but the existence of democratic institutions alone is not sufficient. In this context, we urge the Commission to continue to reach out to non-governmental organizations as they are the primary vehicle for strengthening civil society, especially in the area of human rights. To the extent that legislators can work with activists and other citizens interested in holding government to its highest ideals, we can find cause for hope to continue down this long road we are traveling to rid the world of torture. Finally, I would like to urge the Commission to continue to reach out to the academic community in particular that is engaged in work directly relevant to the Commission's mandate. There are a great many individuals involved in research that could be useful for understanding and improving human rights conditions. Unfortunately, these efforts are frequently left within academic journals and conferences hidden behind inaccessible jargon. In short, we don't get out much, and we surely need to. If, as a member of this community, we can assist you in any way, please feel free to contact any of us in the future. I thank you very much for your attention and interest.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Our next witness will be Mr. Malcolm Wrightson Nance, who's Director of Special Readiness Services International and Director of International Anti-Terrorism Center for Excellence. Mr. Nance is a 20-year veteran of the U.S. intelligence community's Combating Terrorism Program. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I'm honored to be here to speak to you today on an issue of great importance. My name is Malcolm Nance. I'm a 20-year veteran of the intelligence community, where I served as a cryptologist, Arabic interpreter, field interrogator, and instructor at the U.S. Navy Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape School, known as SEER. In my civilian capacity, I continue to serve as an advisor, educator, and scholar in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency intelligence. I come today as an intelligence professional with a dire warning. As I've testified before a similar hearing in the House, while at SEER, one of my most serious responsibilities was to employ, supervise, and witness dramatic and highly kinetic coercive interrogation methods, including a wide range of activities now referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques. This included hands-on, short-duration, high-intensity brutality, such as face slapping, painful stress positions, simulated sexual assault, mock executions, and the most severe, waterboarding. I have testified that waterboarding, of which I was subjected to the maximum limit allowable, is a professional process when done in the hands of a competent team. It is also an inhumane, cruel, degrading torture that was applied regularly by the most evil enemies fought by this nation's armed forces, including the Nazis and the North Vietnamese. Let us put the techniques aside. We face a crisis because of the belief in a myth. The myth that torture is effective and can gain the truth from a subject has been praised and endorsed by many of our highest citizens. In light of public opposition to torture, some members of the American intelligentsia have called for a third way regarding torture and would support it under certain conditions. Recently, no less august personality than the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard University, Alan M. Dershowitz, advocated torture. He recently and publicly stated that torture should be one of the legal tools to fight terrorism in the ticking time bomb scenario. He called for the creation of a torture warrant, whereby torture would legally be authorized to extract information critical to stopping an imminent attack. This medieval, arcane, and ignorant misimpression of what he labeled extreme measures would authorize the president to use torture and provide legal grounds to conduct brutality. In my view, it is a license to return to the Middle Ages and provide a judicial basis for a 21st century inquisition. It will create an ironclad international standard through which past and future torturers can claim innocence. By Dershowitz's hypothesis, Nazi SS officer Klaus Barbie's interrogations and tortures of French resistance members was acceptable to stop their form of terrorism. By this reading, all of Pol Pot's torture orders were justifiable. There is clearly a particular madness that the image and allure of brutalizing one's enemies afflicts those who are furthest away from the bloodshed. And believe me, I am very close to the bloodshed. These advocates of murder and brutality must be reminded in the strongest terms that the honored service of the American Armed Forces and intelligence community is not their play toy. Unlike the present illegal coercion and torture activities, which the administration has embraced in defiance of U.S. and international law, the activities of the SEER program were honorable demonstrations in a simulated captive environment, which inoculated our students to the experience of high-intensity stress and duress. We now learn that this historic body of torture knowledge wrought from the pain and graves of tens of thousands of American prisoners of war from the Revolution to Iraq and Afghanistan was the template for Department of Defense and CIA processing of al-Qaeda prisoners. The thought that we decided to use our enemy's torture playbook is too disgusting to imagine. Torture must be banned by this nation, and we must strive to regain the moral high ground. We must call for a new Geneva Convention where the laws regarding the activities of enemy combatants and their handling of them on and off the battlefield can be reset to the lowered bar of justice. America's honor must be restored. To do that, we must embrace our cherished values as fair and decent people and hold to account those who have ordered and conducted illegal activities in our name. Thank you.
Let me turn, if I might, to the justification used by many to say why we have to use torture, and that is the ticking bomb. Several of you talked about the ticking bomb scenario, where you're confronted with a desperate situation where information is vital in order to protect the safety of the people of our community, and you have someone in custody who perhaps has that information, and you don't have the time to go through the niceties, so why not just use methods that can solicit at least some information in a timely fashion? Why not allow, under extreme circumstances as determined by whether it's the torture warrant, I think you said you suggested, perhaps a court makes that judgment, perhaps the president, why not permit torture under those circumstances? Mr. Nance, you want to?
Well, it's quite simple. As Professor Dershowitz recommended, the torture warrant, it's laughable on its face, in the sense that in counterterrorism, you are constantly facing the ticking time bomb. You're talking about an asymmetric threat of people who are in a constant state of planning, readiness, and going through an operational cycle to deploy weapons systems or terrorist systems or activities of which you would consider imminent at all times. If that were the case, there would have been large-scale and widespread torture more than there was in Northern Ireland with the British throughout the 1970s and 1980s because they were under constant IRA bombing threat, which means that every individual that you would get into your custody would be a potential imminent ticking time bomb threat candidate for a torture warrant.
I agree. I think by definition, we wouldn't have the people under interrogation unless there was some information that was critically important for us to have in order to avoid a disaster. We never know exactly when bombs are going to go off, so I guess they're always ticking. Dr. Hilde, did you want to comment further on that?
Well, the International Red Cross did mention at one point that they considered 90% of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison to be innocent. So if we're involved in seeking a ticking time bomb moral justification to torture individual human beings, and we're all of a sudden discovering that 90% of the people in custody are actually innocent, I think we're faced with only finding ex post facto justifications, morally speaking, which should come prior to the actual torture. And that may never be the actual dramatic version of the ticking time bomb, but rather something along the lines of where is a weapons cache? Where is an IED? Do we wish to allow torture to be institutionalized in order to find this sort of daily information? There is definitely a tragic decision to be made there. But the ticking time bomb example takes it all out of proportion. It's usually torturing the one versus saving the city of New York. And that's a terribly poor basis for a moral argument.
Clearly, and of course, the ticking time bomb definition is subjected to a great deal of abuse, as Mr. Nance has pointed out. And let me just put in the record the quote from the Pentagon Working Group memo of 2003. Army interrogation experts view the use of force as an inferior technique that yields information of questionable quality. So that if you really are confronted with a very time-sensitive episode, you may very well find that by using torture, you're going to waste the valuable time that you do have by tracking down information that's not reliable in the first place. So there's a question of reliability as well as one of definition, in addition to the moral issues and the legal issues that, that many of you have raised. Dr. Davenport, do you want to comment on that?
Well, in part to kind of step away from the ticking time bomb for a second and think more of more mundane aspects of it as well. So if you look at there's an organization called Relatives for Justice in West Belfast that documents kind of everyday experience of people in Northern Ireland. And yes, there was certain periods where there was a constant threat, but then this did not explain the kind of rather broad net that was cast across much of the Catholic community to kind of prosecute them in a certain way and intimidate them. So torture had a different effect. You weren't trying to elicit information in that context. You were trying to intimidate. So I think we kind of forget that sometimes. And I think also the law enforcement applications we also kind of forget as well, because we focus on the military context. We forget that just a lot of kind of mundane aspects of law enforcement. I'm from New York, so Amadou Diallo, I think there's many instances of torture that have taken place with regards to just like law enforcement scenarios that tend to get forgotten because of this highly politicized dealing with terrorist organizations or civil war context. We just have kind of everyday life as well.
Dr. Davenport, your numbers are very, very troubling as to the number of countries that have condoned the use of torture, particularly those that share common values that we have been trying to provide international leadership. We talk about our Western values, we talk about our American values, we talk about countries that share those values, and many of our policies, international policies, foreign policy, our foreign aid budget, so much of it is based upon trying to be a leader on Western values. And yet your statistics indicate that many of our countries would condone the use of torture. And then you take a look at some of the public opinion polls, and it's mixed. It's not as strong as many of us would like to see in condemning the use of torture. Could you just give me a little bit more information about how you conducted that research? As you say, when torture is used, countries don't issue press releases. How did you do your research?
Interestingly enough, particular project, the paper that I reported here was drawn from State Department country reports and Amnesty International and other sources that basically try to catalog this as best they can from human rights organizations quite frequently on the ground. So yes, there's no press release, but the victims are occasionally tapped by human rights organizations on the ground that then kind of in turn provide that information. This is also consistent though with there's a book that I just had come out called State Repression and the Domestic Democratic Peace, which also shows kind of something very similar in the sense that not all aspects of democracy are equally important for reducing human rights violations. So to that extent, the way we've kind of broadly cast our conception of what we think of as democratizing or the most important institutions in bringing about that reduction in human rights is not as consistent as we would like. So there's certain aspects of it. The electoral dimension is not as important as the development of civil society, is not as important as electoral competition, diverse parties as well.
So where do we go? How did this come about? How could democratic countries say that torture can be done by us, but not by our enemies, because our values are consistent with the use of torture? How could that happen? Where are our vulnerabilities? In order to try to correct this, how did this come about?
It seems as if, historically democracy has been very good at eliminating the most egregious and the most obvious forms of state abuse towards its citizens. And with increased accountability comes an increased desire to hide your abuses, which would lead directly to greater torture. So in a sense, it's a different correlation than we'd like, but we've, through promoting democracy, we've kind of shifted the plane. I mean, we haven't necessarily eliminated the problem of order. We've shifted the way in which most states will engage in it. And we've kind of prompted individuals to engage in the more hidden forms of repressive activities that are harder to detect, are perhaps the most persistent historically in many respects. And so I think that kind of speaks to the paradox you rose.
Dr. Davenport, on the circumstances that lead democracies to regress, elaborate just a little bit on what you mean when you talk about violent dissent insofar as your research demonstrated. Can you elaborate on what effect those same circumstances have on other human rights? And that is, do you see an effect of violent dissent on, say, free speech or democratic governance or free elections?
By violent dissent, generally focusing on civil war and insurgency, specific acts of terrorism that involve destruction of property and individuals. We're in the process now of actually going through and trying to assess which rights and which personal integrity violations are most threatened by this. In my book, I identify that the predominant influences of democracy are most effective at eliminating or reducing physical integrity violations, so mass killing, imprisonment, torture, disappearances, and less effective with regards to speech, association, and so forth. So those are the most vulnerable within the context of domestic threats. What I refer to as the domestic democratic peace, the ability of different institutions of democracy to reduce human rights violations, is least effective at trying to counter political violence and conflict situations for the less violent ones, the more sensitized ones, in a sense. So speech and association are the ones most vulnerable when we're fighting violent dissident activities, when the state is fighting violent dissident activities. Those are the things that are most threatened.
Since you and your colleagues did your research and now are published, at least in academia, has that brought further attention worldwide to the empirical data gathering information that you're doing?
In my opinion, no. Part of the difficulty is, I think, the community has been distracted by discussions about civil war and terrorism and the ramifications of human rights and the effectiveness of democracy in improving this situation has not necessarily been as thoroughly investigated as we would like.
In your data compilation, did you eventually come to conclusions at this point in the 80%, for example, of the countries that, as I recall, you said, permitted torture at least once during a specified period of time? Did you come to a determination as to numerically which were the worst offenders and which were the least offenders?
One could, with our analysis, do that. It's this one of those kind of cultural things. In academia, where the naming and shaming element of exactly what we do is kind of antithetical in many respects to what people would like to know. But
y'all need a good dose of politics.
Exactly. But very easily we could identify the ranking of who the worst and who are the best conditions. We'd also like to try to expand it to try to think of not just that torture takes place, but also the scope throughout the population and get a general sense of exactly how many people are being implicated.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to excerpts from a hearing of the U.S. Helsinki Commission held December 10, 2007 at the University of Maryland. The questioners were chair and co-chair, Representative Alcee Hastings of Florida and Senator Benjamin Cardin of Maryland. We heard testimony from witnesses Professor Thomas Hilde, a U of Maryland ethicist, Professor Christian Davenport, a U of Maryland political scientist who has made a study of torture in democracies, and Malcolm Nance, an intelligence professional with experience in interrogation as well as interrogation resistance training for the U.S. military. The entire hearing can be viewed as streaming video at c-span.org under their recent video section. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests can be downloaded from the archives at unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening. Welcome, yeah.